From NPR and WBUR, I'm Lisa Mullins in Boston.
I'm Peter O'Dowd in Phoenix. This is Here and Now. A flood on the Pearl River in Jackson, Mississippi has wiped out the city's largest water treatment plant. In a press conference last night, Mississippi Governor Tate Reeves explained what losing the aging infrastructure means for the capital city of 150,000 people.
It means the city cannot produce enough water to fight fires, to reliably flush toilets, and to meet other critical needs.
The governor has called in the National Guard to help distribute bottled water. Alex Rozier is in Jackson. He's the environment reporter for Mississippi Today. Hi, Alex.
Hi, Peter. Thanks for having me.
Sure. So, you know, on one hand, this was a crisis averted because just a few days ago, the mayor was telling people to flee the city before the Pearl River crested. It wasn't as bad as expected, but then the water system breaks down. What happened?
Yeah, that's right. So yesterday afternoon, the mayor held a press conference saying because of the high levels of water on the Pearl, the water treatment plant was having issues intaking water to be able to treat it for drinking water for the city, and that as a result, the city would have low water pressure. Fast forward a few hours later, the governor holds a separate press conference without the mayor or any city officials, saying the treatment plant that the mayor is talking about is potentially on the verge of failing completely.
I understand the governor also said that the city won't have reliable running water at scale for the foreseeable future. So what does that mean? I mean, do people have any water at all to drink when they turn on the faucets?
Yeah, so just to be clear, it's an evolving situation, and we don't really know how bad it is right now. The governor and officials last night were unable to say how many people exactly are without water or with low water pressure. We do know that there are a number of businesses without water completely. Yesterday, the public school district, Jackson Public Schools, announced that they were going virtual, doing remote learning for the foreseeable future. So the state is going into the water plant today to do a full assessment of the situation. So we'll know more today, but it is definitely a scary prospect.
It's scary for a lot of reasons. I mean, I'm sorry to get into the details here, but how are people flushing their toilets? I mean, the city's going to have to manage wastewater for an entire city.
Yeah, that's right. So the state emergency management agency is planning to distribute potable and non-potable water to help folks flush their toilets. Again, we don't know at this point how many people are unable to flush their toilets right now, but that was the situation that the governor outlined yesterday, which is that he said we might not have enough water to fight fires, flush toilets, and other critical needs such as health and sanitary use.
So the context here, I think, is very important because even before the storm, Jackson residents had been under a boil water order for the past month or so. They are very common water problems in the city. So how does this most recent breakdown fit into the bigger issue with water infrastructure in Jackson?
Yeah, that's right. The water plant at hand, O.B. Curtis, has been failing for quite a while now. So like you said, residents are very used to, for one reason or another, having to boil their water before using it to eat, brush their teeth, and other uses. This latest boil water notice, which is still going on, has lasted for over a month now. Yeah, the infrastructure, whether it's distribution, whether it's pumps at the plant, and then going to, you know, things like staffing needs. There are just a number of things going wrong with the Jackson water system that have been happening for quite a while now.
Yeah, for some time. Last year, the head of the EPA was there in Jackson to talk about the infrastructure decay and how it related to environmental justice issues in a city where more than 80% of the population is Black. Is anyone, any government agency stepping up to fund the improvements that need to happen so that people can get reliable water in their homes?
Well, the state, you know, and the city definitely got some money from the latest federal infrastructure bill. It's not near what the city needs just for the drinking water system. That's not to mention the failing wastewater system for which the city's under a federal consent decree. And the city has reached out to the state in the months leading up to this saying, you know, we need more of the infrastructure money because at one point last year, after the city had a failure after the winter storms, The mayor basically said we need $1 billion to fix the city's drinking water system. So we've gotten some money, but it's a tall order, and you know, it's unclear where the rest of that money is going to come from.
And just briefly before I let you go, Alex, how are you coping with all this? You live in Jackson. I mean, how long are you prepared for this to go on?
I'm prepared. You know, I'm just put some water in the toilet just in case we need to flush the toilets. I have running water right now. Like I said, I know some businesses are without water, but I don't live in the western or southern parts of the city, which are also the poorest and blackest parts of the city. And they're also the farthest away from the treatment plant. So usually when we have water pressure issues, those are the areas that get the brunt of these issues.
Alex Rozier, environmental reporter for Mississippi Today. Thank you so much. Good luck.
Thanks, Peter.
To the White House now, President Biden has had a pretty good month. He has celebrated policy accomplishments. They include a massive spending bill to fight climate change, to making good on his campaign promise to cancel student loan debt. But as with Democratic presidents before him, Biden is not satisfied progressive in his own party or Republicans outside of it. Julian Zelizer is familiar with this tightrope act. He is professor of history at Princeton. And Julian, you place Joe Biden's decision to cancel student loan debt for many but not all borrowers in the tradition of Democratic presidents making big promises and then delivering incremental outcomes. And you say it goes all the way back to FDR when he pushed for Social Security, which left a lot of people out. Make the link for us there.
Sure. Democratic presidents have continued to try to balance the demands from the base of the party with the difficulties and realities of Capitol Hill. So one example is Franklin Roosevelt during the 1930s creates Social Security in 1935, but excludes many workers, domestic workers, agricultural workers from the bill, in part because Southern Democrats insisted on that to preserve the racial structures of the South. But the program got through, and over time, it would expand. And so that's an early origin story of a president trying to decide how to navigate these two parts of politics.
Right. It's navigation. I mean, kind of dealing with real politics. Fast forward now to Lyndon Johnson. When he was Senate Majority Leader, he passed a civil rights bill, but a weak one. How did that rather modest accomplishment then set up his domestic agenda when he became president?
Yeah, this was legislation which in 57, most liberals, not just progressives on the left, were complaining about. It was a pretty watered down piece of legislation. But as Robert Caro wrote in his famous book on this moment, Johnson argued that if he could get one bill, one civil rights bill through Congress in the post-Reconstruction era, it would open the door for more. And he would familiarize politicians with voting for something like this. And over time, he would be able to expand on it. And that's exactly what happened. And when he became president, the Civil Rights Act of 64 and the Voting Rights Act of 65 marked the culmination of that strategy.
And that's what Joe Biden says will happen as well. So when presidents, Johnson and beyond that, have pushed for modest achievements, expecting their full vision to be eventually realized, how often does that happen?
Not always. These bills expand, the programs become more robust, but a counterexample is in 1965, Johnson pushes through Congress Medicare and Medicaid. The idea is, even though Truman had failed to achieve national health insurance, this was a first step. But over time, the ambitions of growing Medicare and Medicaid into truly a national single-payer insurance program didn't happen. And instead, what we have is a kind of jerry-built, multi-layered structure that still leaves many Americans without adequate health insurance and still leaves costs very high for many Americans. So that prediction doesn't always come true.
And you're talking about Lyndon Johnson's era there. Presidents are not kings. They can't unilaterally declare policy, but they have had to deal with Congress to pass their goals. And I wonder if, given the fact that the country is more polarized now, what kind of room there is for political pragmatism?
Not much. Polarization of the sort that we have means that a Democratic president can't expect Republican support on almost anything. And in addition, President Biden in particular is dealing with extraordinarily narrow majorities, which means there's no room to lose everyone. So what's interesting is the way President Biden has been able to maneuver through polarization, through a narrow majority, and still come away right now with a pretty sizable legislative record.
A sizable record, and in terms of student debt relief, Republicans are worried that it might make inflation worse, while progressives, Bernie Sanders, among others, wanted Biden to go a lot further. What is the White House gambling on? Is it doing this to be designed for the Democrats in the midterms, very briefly?
I think it's being designed, including the executive order, for legacy building, and it's also meant to bolster Democrats in the midterms, but that might not happen. Often presidents get a lot of legislation, but the midterms don't reward that.
Julian Zelizer, professor of history at Princeton, thank you very much.
Thanks for having me.
Critics of President Biden's decision to forgive some student debt say the policy doesn't get to the root of the problem, why college is so expensive in the U.S. Yesterday, I spoke with Beth Akers, an economist who worked in the George W. Bush administration, now a senior fellow at the American Enterprise Institute. Akers told me she's concerned the cost of tuition might actually go up faster because some student loans are getting wiped away.
If borrowers are thinking about that as they consider how much to spend on college and how much to borrow, they may be willing to pay more. That's essentially an increase in demand, and that allows institutions, even well-meaning institutions, to raise their prices.
Let's take a step back and examine the reasons why college already is so expensive and what's driving costs so high that the sticker price for a year at New York University, for example, is $83,000. Lee Gardner, senior writer with the Chronicle of Higher Education, joins us now. Lee, welcome.
Thank you.
So first of all, we just heard Beth Akers say that student debt forgiveness could raise the cost of college. To people who share that concern, you say what?
Well, the cost of college is likely to increase over time, regardless of what happens with student debt. I don't know that I see a direct relationship between forgiving a relatively modest amount of student debt compared to the overall amount of student debt with an increase in college prices. I don't know if I see a direct link for a variety of reasons.
What is the direct link for the increase in college prices? I mean, we mentioned NYU in the introduction there, but if you look at a public school, Ohio State, for example, we looked it up. Room and board, in-state tuition adds up to $26,000 a year. These are bills that are very tough for people to pay.
Well, they are. College is expensive by any measure. Including down to the community college level in many states. Over time, states have disinvested in higher ed. It's gone down by at least 10% in the last two decades. And that has helped shift the burden onto families. One of the other things that's driven college costs is that students and families and state and federal governments ask more of colleges these days. Students come to college in many cases less well-prepared than they might have in the past. And so there's more requests for, more demand for tutoring and academic support. There's also more requests for mental health support, frankly, coming from students and families. Yeah. And that has meant colleges hiring additional people.
I see. So, I mean, other people would point to this college business model in the U.S. that's been developing over the past few decades. It's been called the corporate college model, with a college president seen as the CEO of a business that needs to turn a profit. Is that part of the problem?
You know, colleges are in a more precarious position in a lot of ways than they might have been in the past. There's a scholar named Nathan Graw who projected that the number of college-going high school graduates is projected to decline in this country, in certain areas of the country, by as much as 15% over the next 10 years. A lot of colleges are already feeling that pinch in their enrollments, especially a lot of small private colleges, for example, a lot of regional public institutions. All of this is not to say that the corporatization, as you're calling it, of higher ed is good or beneficial, but in many cases, some of the things that college leaders are doing they're doing to try to help those institutions survive in a situation where competition for resources and students is becoming more intense.
What is the solution to all this? How do we make college more affordable?
Well, if I knew that, I could go off and be a consultant and make the big money. A smart person once said to me that colleges are really good at starting things, but they're not good at stopping things. That is, you know, they start programs in this and an institute of that, and those things tend to go on. But colleges are not necessarily good at evaluating the things that perhaps aren't contributing as much as they need to financially or to the mission of the institution anymore. This is not my opinion. That's what people tell me. You know, it's a complex equation to try to figure out, you know, what to offer in these situations, because it's not just a matter of money. It's a matter of mission and what people come to you for, which is a very complex complex topic if you've ever tried to guide your own offspring through the college selection process.
Lee Gardner is a senior writer for the Chronicle of Higher Education. Thank you, Lee.
Most welcome. Thanks for having me.
Tonight, at a town baseball field not far from Fenway Park in Boston, Jim Hennessy will umpire his last game. Hennessy was born and bred in Brookline, Massachusetts, and has called balls and strikes for Little League, high school, and adult softball teams for 63 consecutive seasons. That's about 7,000 games. Not bad for a man close to 85 years old, which you are right now, 84, Jim Hennessy. I am told that your kids have been after you to retire, and I wonder what made you finally come around at age 84.
Well, Lisa, I was sitting on the beach about 3 weeks ago, and just my wife and I late in the day, and she said to me, you know, I think it's about time. You're going to be 85 in 2 months, and I don't know how many 85-year-olds are still doing what you're doing. And I thought about it overnight and told her the next morning I was going to be done by the end of the month.
Did your wife have that much influence on you always, or had you been thinking about it?
I had been thinking about it, Lisa, but no, she's a great lady, and she's been a big influence on my life. We're married for close to 62 years, and, you know, she's been big part of who I am.
So it doesn't sound like she's a baseball widow. It sounds like she's been a major part of your life, despite the fact that for 63 seasons you've been umpiring. And I wonder, when you first started off, 1959, you were trying to earn a little bit of money, which you did, but what kept you doing it for so long?
Lisa, year after year, it was just automatic. I started doing Little League and then high school and softball leagues, and end of April every year is just time to go back to work again. It was just a thing that I enjoyed doing.
Why do you enjoy it? What's good about it? Because umpires take a lot of ribbing, and
you know, I never felt that way, Lisa. I always try to be fair. The only thing I ever tried to do was when I went to work at night, do the best job I possibly could.
So your kids, who are completely unbiased, tell me that you are the most kind, gentle, respectful man in the world. And I wonder, as an umpire, when you have to take lip from somebody who calls you a banana head or maybe does something even worse, what do you do? How do you respond?
Very quietly, Lisa, I'll just go over and say, okay, you made your point. You got about 10 more seconds. End it. No profanity, no more yelling, and it's over. And if they persist, I'll give them one warning. And if they persist again, I tell them to go to your car. You're out of here. I've done that very few times, Lisa. I haven't done that very often.
Because why? Because the first time around, it's effective enough?
Yes, correct. Correct. I've always been stern, but, you know, I've been fair, and I've never thought anything was about me. It was, and, you know, I respected them, and they respected me.
That's your daughter, Jane, who is giving,
that's me.
Prompting you, and they respect you.
But they do. They think the world of them. They love them to death, all the guys.
Oh, I can imagine. I mean, you sound like a really, really nice guy. Did you always umpire in the same position?
No, either the plate or the bases. You know, one or the other.
It didn't matter to you?
Yeah, it didn't matter, though. And I used to take the six children with me a lot, too, when I was umpiring, you know, baseball games and, you know, pair them off 2-2 and 2. And they were a big part of my life when I was umpiring, too.
That's great. Six children. And just while we're on the subject of taking lip from some people, who's the hardest to what's the hardest age group to umpire for? Who gives you the hardest time?
Probably kids in their 20s, early 30s.
Yeah.
No, but I haven't, at least I haven't come across too many, really. I really haven't. They're respectful. They, you know, I respect them and they respect me.
So for those people who are coming up behind you and want to know how you do it, how you keep your composure, how you maintain respect, what do you say?
Just be yourself. Be honest. Be fair. Don't be argumentative. You know, I used to tell these young umpires who are coming up, the only thing you have to say is six words. Ball strike, fair foul, out safe. And say nothing else.
A man of few, meaning six words.
I am a man of few words, Lisa. Yes, I am.
Over 63 consecutive seasons, but you spoke volumes, even if you didn't talk a lot.
No, I said very little. I let my work, you know, define who I was.
That sounds pretty darn good. Jim Hennessy, so nice to talk to you. Thank you.
Lisa, very nice to talk to you, too. And thank you very much.
And it's county fair season. Things are finally getting back to normal this third summer of the pandemic. Ray Solomon of KUNC takes us to one county fair in rural Colorado where the main attraction isn't the livestock.
It's not that you can't gorge yourself on funnel cake and cotton candy at the Yuma County Fair. There is a midway, after all, with rides and games and all the usual amusements. But that's not the main event here in the county with the second biggest agricultural production in the state. At this fair, the center of gravity is really the grandstand and the show rings where experts judge livestock raised by Yuma County's children. And everyone's attention is focused on the county's most important product, the next generation of farmers.
Leah Richardson.
Cheyenne Janish.
Lucas Pish.
My name is Josiah Uris.
Dean Wingfield was one of those fair kids himself.
This is the 70th fair since I was born, and I'm thinking I've been to 69 fairs.
Wingfield was a county commissioner for 24 years, and he's kind of an expert on the fair here.
Yuma County has always been kind of youth-oriented fair. You know, it's more about the kids. Let them have, you know, their year's bounty come to the fair and show what they've done.
Like the bounty on display at this year's swine show, where Kathy Christensen showed up to support her grandson.
At 12, he won grand champion with his pig one year. I'm bragging a little bit.
That grandson and all the other pig kids have worked hard all spring and summer, raising their animals up from piglets.
Really nice class of heavier weight lambs, 117 to 119 today. And we've got some.
After all the ribbons have been awarded, the kids will auction off their animals at a public sale where supporters often bid prices up to multiples of market value.
Yuma's really, really good about getting into their pockets and giving to these kids.
This year, the kids made sales totaling over $520,000, an all-time record for the fair. The county takes a tiny commission, but the kids get to keep almost all of the proceeds.
Well, you hope you make sale up there, because that's pretty good college fund money.
More than college money, the kids are learning to carry on the work of agricultural production.
They are being raised and trained to feed everybody who is listening to this right now.
Jolyn Midcap coordinates Yuma County's 4-H chapter as a youth development and mentoring program. Some 200 local kids learn animal husbandry, farming, and home ec skills. Midcap says working on 4-H projects and then exhibiting them at the fair is how the culture and skills of agricultural life are passed down through the generations.
4-H is so historically ingrained in this community. You know, everybody's grandparents and great-grandparents did it.
The kids raise livestock and crops. They learn leatherworking, baking, sewing, food preservation, even robotics, because, heck, someone's got to be able to go up against the circuitry of modern farm equipment. And then they come to the fair in August to show off their developing skills and bask in the glow of community recognition.
You're not just showing an exhibit, but you're actually showing and exhibiting a piece of your heart because you raised it and you grew it.
Organizers say the county loses money on the fair each year. But to hear Dean Wingfield tell it, a straight accounting would completely miss the actual value of the county fair.
It was at the fair the first time I saw it, and first of some breeds of cattle. It was something that was new for country kids out here. It was something you really enjoyed and you can't hardly miss.
For Here and Now, I'm Ray Solomon in Yuma County, Colorado.
Kids are heading back to school around the country, and teachers are, as always, trying to help them learn better. Our next guest has one answer to how to do that: get kids to listen better. Monica Brady-Myra founded ListenWise. It's a company that tries to build better listeners in K through 12 classrooms, and she writes about it in her book, ListenWise. I spoke with her last December. We should say right at the top that you're a former reporter for our home station, WBUR. We know each other well. And as a reporter, you first became interested in audio storytelling. But I know that your view of the power of audio has expanded greatly with the help in part of your daughter. And I wonder if you can tell us that story.
Yeah, well, I was working as a reporter at WBUR, and my daughter was in about the third grade learning to read, and she was really struggling. And I got called in to her teacher to talk about what problem she was having and how we could help. But one thing I noticed was that because we listened every morning to NPR on the radio station, she understood everything that she heard. And I knew that if I had put a script in front of her and asked her to read it and have a conversation about the news, she never could have done that. So it just struck me that she is like many children out there who have trouble reading but can understand what they hear much at a much higher level. So that really launched me on this idea of taking all the great audio stories that are happening on public radio and in podcasts and getting them into the hands of teachers so that students like my daughter can succeed through listening.
So you started this company, ListenWise, that uses audio excerpts from, as you said, public radio stories and from podcasts, and you play them for children, or you give instruction on playing them for children. The stories that you pick, what are you looking for in particular, stories that you think would encourage listening?
Well, we're looking for stories that are aligned to what teachers need to teach, first of all, because we want them to use them in the classroom, but just as important as stories that really captivate you, that in just a few short seconds you can transport students somewhere else, either by building empathy with a character, with a person they're listening to, but also just describing other parts of the world and sensory. I mean, listening is such a sensory mode of learning, and we don't always think about it that way because it's sort of a passive thing that we all do. But in reality, we are activating so many parts of our brain when we listen. And I'd love to illustrate something along those lines if we can play a short clip from an NPR story by science reporter Michaeline Dukleff. And as you listen, I want you to think about what you are seeing, what you're feeling, what you're smelling while you're listening.
We've got bug spray, we've got headlamps. We're going into the forest. And it's deep.
And it's steep.
That's Kevin Olival.
Okay.
He's a virus hunter with EcoHealth Alliance, a U.S.-based group of scientists. They fly around the world looking for killer viruses.
It becomes dense right away.
Thorns. He's brought me to a tropical rainforest. We're on the island of Borneo in Malaysia.
This way.
Because this is the type of place where outbreaks are born.
So that clip, I'm curious to hear from you, Lisa. What did that forest look like for you? What did it feel like?
Well, I'd say that it felt like it was buggy. It felt like it was kind of humid and oppressive. And that was in part from the ambience, what we call the ambience, which is the sound behind the story. Is that what you're getting at?
Yeah, I'm getting at the fact that listening is an immersed experience view. That is what neuroscientists call it. Our brains are simulating what it's actually like to be in a scene, especially one as sound rich as the one we just listened to. But imagine if you can take students there really quickly and then illustrate a point about science that you're learning in a classroom. That's what makes listening so powerful in learning.
But does what a student or child is listening to have to have that kind of rich ambience? If it's just a good story, are they going to listen to it then, even if it's sort of bare bones?
Oh, yeah, especially if it's well told. There are studies that show that just telling a good story improves your ability to listen. And the fact is that, like, we don't get better at listening as we get older. We just do that by really practicing listening as a skill. And too many of our educators really have a professional blind spot when it comes to listening. They don't think that it needs to be taught. They focus more on the traditional skills, math and reading, and that's understandable. But listening really is an essential skill that all effective learners need to know and improve.
You know, it's interesting because you say that teachers don't necessarily teach listening, but they sure get angry when kids don't listen, which happens a lot.
Yes, that is so true. I hear that all the time when I say, I've written a book called Listen Wise, teach your students to be better listeners. They say, how? How can I do that? I said, well, you've got to help them exercise their listening muscle.
So I have a question about that, though. Yeah, there is a muscle, but it feels like there is so much working in the opposite direction, you know, in terms of torque. It's like whenever you, for instance, go online, as kids are wont to do, everything is trying to take you in a different direction within a nanosecond of your getting onto it. So, you know, we have short attention spans that are getting shorter all the time, and that includes children. So how on earth do you fight against that by trying to get kids to sort of just sit still and listen?
It's practice. It's really giving the teachers the tools to talk with their students about all the different types of listening that they're doing every day without realizing it. Precise listening, descriptive listening, strategic listening, and really helping them realize that they are in control of this listening muscle. And if they use it well, they're going to have a much easier time remembering the content or being engaged with their friends or not getting yelled at by their teachers or parents for not listening.
There are problems that some people have with the written word. They might have a problem with dyslexia, for instance. And there are inherent problems that people have with listening. How do you work with those?
Well, in terms of the reading challenges, students can listen at 2 to 3 grade levels higher than they can read. And listening is used regularly in the types of remediation for students who are struggling readers. But then there are also, I'm sure, students who struggle with listening. So on our platform and in many of the activities, there are many other supports such as pictures and other things to read that go along with the audio. We have transcripts with every single piece of audio. And that's a research-based, proven approach to improving literacy. Listening and reading at the same time really improves reading.
And you say in the book that if you are a good reader, you're going to be a good listener and vice versa.
Well, right now we know if you're a good listener, you're going to be a better reader. And that's because listening is an essential part of learning to read. It's a combination of decoding and language comprehension. And in our classrooms today, we have many, many ways to measure the reader as they progress up the scale of proficiency. But we don't have a way to measure the listener, even though these are so tightly tied.
Monica, can you talk about the changes that you have seen as a result of students having better developed listening skills?
Oh, I've heard some great stories from teachers. They say their students are more attuned to the world, that they're really absorbing material through listening, that then they will recount details of 2 weeks later, that there's a level of retention that's impressive, and that it's been a great way for students to get background knowledge about maybe a book that they're about to read. And they listen to an interview with Lois Lowry about why she wrote The Giver, let's say, and that really tunes them in and gets them excited to read.
You're speaking to a lot of parents in the audience. If they want to do one thing tonight with their child to get them to learn to listen, what would you recommend?
Well, I'd recommend what we do around our dining room table, which is just start by listening to your kids intentionally and giving them the space to talk and be heard. So we have a tradition in our family where we just ask a few simple questions. How was your day? Tell me one good thing. Tell me one bad thing that happened. Then we always ask them, and what did you do that was nice for someone else? And it gives them the power to speak as well as listen and share a little bit of themselves. And that's really what listening is all about.
So you're teaching them how to listen by you're doing the listening yourself.
Yeah, we are showing them. That is the number one thing. And when teachers ask me, I don't know how to get my students to listen, I say, well, have you taught them how to listen by showing them that you're listening and how you listen? Talk about what good listening requires of you, that you have eye contact and you're nodding and you're not looking at your phone and you're parroting back what they say. Maybe you're asking a follow-up question. All of these things happen at our dinner table too. And that is what has built, I think, a strength of listening among our daughters. And I think it's easy for anyone to do too.
Monica Brady Myroff's book is called Listen Wise: Teach Students to Be Better Listeners. Monica, thank you.
It's been a pleasure. Thanks for listening.
Next time you see a colony of ants hanging out in your garden, it might be a good idea to just let them be. New research shows that ants can be more effective than pesticides. The study looked at 17 different plants, including mangoes, citrus, and soybeans, and found that ants hunted the pests that can sometimes plague these crops. Researchers say the discovery could make farming more sustainable. Let's bring in Adam Hart. He's an entomologist and professor of science communication at the University of Gloucestershire. Adam, welcome. Good to speak with you.
Thank you. It's good to be here.
Yeah, so you were not involved in the research, but you have spent a lot of time studying ants. Was the news that they might be better than pesticides for farmers much of a surprise to you?
I'll be honest with you, it kind of wasn't. It was very welcome, though, to see all of that research being put together in this big sort of review because, you know, as someone that studies ants and insects generally, I spend quite a lot of time persuading people that there's more to them than meets the eye and that although they may be a bit annoying at times, they actually have an amazing kind of use throughout the environment. So to have this sort of written down and demonstrated so effectively that they're actually extremely useful pest controllers was really helpful.
Well, right. I mean, as a casual gardener, I didn't even realize that ants were considered predators. I thought they were themselves the pests. So what do they like to eat?
Yeah, a lot of people are surprised by that, actually. But yeah, ants are pretty effective predators. They'll take off all sorts of pests that you find on plants, things like scale insects, for example, they'll go after. In some cases, they'll go after aphids, but in other cases, they'll actually farm aphids. So they look after them, and then they'll eat the honeydew that comes out of their back ends that aphids produce when they're feeding on plants. So that can be a little bit of a problem, actually. That's what this research also shows. It's quite a delicate balance. So in some cases, ants can be quite harmful, actually. They can encourage aphids, but overall, their sort of predatory presence on plants is very, very helpful. So they are overall very good pest controllers.
So the important thing here is that they could be seen as an alternative to pesticides because, you know, pesticides, they help us grow a lot of our food, but they're also pretty harmful to our health and to the environment. Do you think it's feasible that farmers could really start to use ants instead of chemicals to do the job?
Yeah, I think it's certainly feasible. We need to look at much more integrated solutions to pest management. The fact is, if you grow lots of crops, it's all the same sort of crops, usually very closely genetically related in a big field. It is an absolute amazing resource for any pest that can get a toehold. So we do have to use some sort of pest control. But as you say, pouring pesticides, pouring chemicals onto the land is not the ideal solution, in all honesty. So if we can come up with these integrated methods where we can take advantage of natural systems, we can take advantage of the fact that ants can be really, really useful pest controllers, for example. We can supply ants with a few of the things that they like, really encouraging them in there, and it could be really, really useful. But what we need to do, I mean, it's no surprise to hear an ant scientist sort of say this, but we need more research. We do need more information. But it's certainly very promising, and it certainly points towards that as being a very useful solution.
There are at least 14,000 known species of ants. And as you say, many of them might actually encourage other bugs to stick around and farm them, as you say. So what are the potential risks of using ants as a natural pest control?
Yeah, well, as you say, ants are very diverse, and they have not just a diversity of species, but actually a diversity of habits and ecology as well. So what you don't want to be doing is thinking, oh, this paper says that ants are good for crops, so I'll go and buy a load of ants on the internet and chuck them out on my garden and that'll be good. Some ants are highly invasive, for example, fire ants. They can spread very, very rapidly, get a toehold, they can change the ecology of an area and cause all sorts of problems. So not every ant is going to be necessarily good. And what the work actually shows is that not every agricultural system shows such a big benefit. Interestingly, they showed really high benefits being in crops that were grown in shaded areas, which I thought was really interesting, and mixed crops.
Okay, before I let you go, you spent a lot of time studying these tiny little bugs, but they're actually fascinating creatures. What's your favorite bit of ant trivia that you like to trot out at a cocktail party?
Well, you know, I started studying ants by studying a group called the leaf-cutting ants, which you find down in Central and South America and just coming up into Texas. And they're the ones that you'll see on nature documentaries carrying fragments of leaves above their head. And they are just phenomenal. And when you dig into one of those colonies, it can take days and days to get there. And there are thousands of ants coming out. A big colony can have, well, I mean, some people say as many as 10 million individuals. And you realize that all of that has come from one single queen. And I think for me, that's the most amazing thing. She will start a colony on her own. With nothing, basically, but what she can carry inside her, you know, some fat deposits and a pair of very active ovaries. And from that, she is able to dig a hole in the ground and produce. She spits up the tiniest little bit of fungus she's taken from the nest, and she starts from scratch that entire colony. And when you go and see those massive colonies, they're maybe, you know, 5 or 6 years old, and they're enormous, like this massive underground city. Yeah, it's a really incredible thing that started just from a single individual. So that's my favorite thing about ants, I think.
Wow. Adam Hart, entomologist and professor of science communication at the University of Gloucestershire. Thank you so much.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure.
Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR. I'm Peter O'Dowd in Phoenix.
And I'm Lisa Mullins in Boston. This is Here and Now.